Hello, and welcome to the Architects of Destination Advocacy Podcast from Destinations International, the international trade association representing destination organizations. This podcast has been exclusively produced by Relic Agency. I'm Andreas Weisenborn, joined with Jack Johnson of Destinations International. Today, we are proud to welcome you to our podcast in a title we both share in part or in full, Advocacy. For this series, we wanted to tell the story of usual and unusual suspects in our sector's history and key advocacy moments for them. We tend for these stories to tell the tale in full, containing both joy and triumph or crisis and disappointment. Each month, we will be joined by guests to tell their tale and a key moment in their destination's history. These are your architects of destination advocacy. For this month's episode and our second, we wanted to spend some time at the beginning to expand on what is happening in our world, in our sector, during this moment in time when we're recording. So right now, today, we're recording in late spring for us. I thought it'd be a good point to bring up and talk about our events, something like the rest of the sector in the industry has been largely transformed or put on hold. So I actually wanted to ask a question first of everyone on the podcast was, what was the last event in the industry that you attended in person, pre-pandemic, as you say it? So myself, Andreas, I'll answer first. I was a guest speaker at the Minnesota State Tourism Conference in person, doing the Lexicon Community Shared Value in February. And I do remember the economist there, Anibon Basu from Sage Policy, said it was tracking about how well tourism is doing, that kind of stuff, and then made very small mention of the coronavirus happening in the world and just said, you know, this could turn into something, but I don't think it's going to turn into anything. And that was it. That's all I remember. And then here we are. So Jack, yourself?
End of February last year. I actually had traveled four straight weeks in February, which is rare. I usually get one or two off. It would have been the Wyoming Governor's Conference in Tourism. But I remember flying there, not really thinking that coronavirus was going to be the big thing it was. But by the time I flew back, the news had pretty much break it and everyone was like talking about it. And I, for the first time, felt uneasy walking through an airport. And that was it. Looking forward to next month when we actually do something.
Yeah. And so for actually guests today, Gabe Cedar, when was your last industry event? Noticing you also started two for us in 2020 as well.
Yeah. I think that the last time I got in an airplane before the pandemic was to go to Irving, Texas for a DMAP board meeting with Mara Gast and the DMAP board. And same as Jack, I mean, I remember flying down. It was, you know, it had been kind of in the news. I think maybe there had been one or two cases reported on the West Coast. And just in a couple of days that I was there, it had, you know, really taken over the news. And so I was flying back in, you know, mid-March or so. And, you know, just by the time I was flying back, you know, half the airplane was wearing masks and, you know, everybody was very uneasy. And came back, and I'm not even sure that we went back into the office. I think that you know, that was kind of that transitional point in time where we went home at first, just, you know, for a couple of days, that turned into 14 or 15 months at this point.
All right, so we got Minnesota, Wyoming, and Irving. That's it. That's what's etched in our memory from. So I think, like the rest of the industry, we've been grounded, you know, but it hasn't stopped what we've done, the core part of us, which is the events. So, you know, since that moment in time, we converted to entirely virtual, you know, with a major virtual annual convention and conference, and then our subsequent summits as well. So upcoming, actually, in a matter of weeks and then months, is going to be our first true hybrid event. The first actually being CEO Summit in Florida. So, Jack, I know you're attending that. I just kind of want to ask, what are your thoughts to actually returning back literally to a physical stage again?
I can't wait, actually. I really like to travel. And there's a lot of good friends I've been talking to for, what, last 14, 15 months remotely. So CEO Summit's always great because it's, you know, not too big in size. It's usually around 200 people. And most of them are people I would consider friends. So I'm pretty looking forward to that. That said, we're doing hybrid, which we've never done before. Yeah. So we're actually going to be interesting to see how that works, because we're not just taking the content that's there and putting it on the screen. We're actually developing content aimed at the hybrid audience, excuse me, the virtual audience, some of which will be shared with the in-person audience. So it's literally like two events happening simultaneously.
Yeah, we should explain that for us, the audience for hybrid is both equally. You know, we look at both the physical attendee and the virtual attendee in the same and want to make sure we have the same experience we best we can for that. This leads me back to the question I want to ask you, Gabe. I think for a lot of us here at the at Destination International, the rite of passage is like you always remember your first annual. And yours was in like one of the lost years, I'll call it, the 2020. This is going to be your first rite of passion and be it hybrid. I'm just curious for yourself, what are you hoping to expect going through a hopefully an on-present annual for the hybrid component of it?
That's a good question. I'm not really sure what to expect, to be honest with you. You know, I think as we're recording this, you know, I think, again, we're going through another sort of transitional phase where guidance around, you know, wearing masks and indoor gatherings is being loosened at the federal level. And obviously, you know, states as well are following that. And so I think, you know, a lot could change between now and when that event happens in July. I expect that there'll be some kind of difference in the way that people approach, you know, meeting in groups between now and then. But yeah, I mean, it's really kind of new ground, new territory for everybody. So I'm not really sure what to expect, to be honest, Andreas.
I do want to ask both of you, do you all think hybrid's here to stay?
I go back and forth. On the one hand, hybrid allows you to access a whole group of people that you wouldn't necessarily access by doing everything in person. That was one of the great things about the 2020 convention is our number. We had over 3,000 people, which is, you know, well over 1,000 more people than we normally would have in person.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's just expensive and it is hard to coordinate. I mean, it does have a lot of time, staff time that is devoted to that, that I don't think anyone can appreciate unless you've actually gone through it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I go back and forth. I think there's always going to be some sort of hybrid element. I just don't know whether it'll actually be like we're doing it where we got two side-by-side events happening.
Yeah, that's a great point. Like we don't want it to make it seem like it is two different distinct events. The success in the hybrid is that it feels like it's one cohesive event, regardless if you're virtual or physical. Gabe, I was just curious, your thoughts, do you think hybrid's here to stay?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not, you know, a meeting planner. You know, I don't really have a strong background in that, but my observation would be, yeah, absolutely. I think it's here to stay. I mean, to Jack's point, you know, whether events are coordinated in, you know, in a hybrid way where you've got sort of live events and digital events occurring simultaneously, you know, I don't know. But I mean, if we've learned anything in the past year, it's that, you know, technology allows us to provide, you know, maybe 90% of the benefit of an in-person event with a much lower barrier to entry for the participants. If you're able to save, you know, the time and the expense of traveling, you know, I think it allows you to, you know, experience these events, you know, with just a much lower barrier to entry. That might not make me a lot of friends among the audience for the podcast, but, you know, I think that's a reality that we're going to have to contend with. And if you make your living developing and, you know, producing and hosting in-person events, then you better have a good answer for why that event is necessary and what sort of benefit you're able to provide on an in-person event that a digital or virtual event cannot provide. And, you know, there's probably an answer out there, but you better be pretty damn sure that you can articulate that, you know, in a way that resonates and makes sense.
I think Jack has the answer.
There are a lot of great stories that we had from our members who may have gathered in the conference room and watched it as a team. So they still had some sort of interaction, human interaction going on. I've heard dozens of stories about how young employees get to go to, like the 30 under 30s get to go to the annual convention, and it just kind of expands your whole horizon there in so many different ways. So most of those guys don't get a chance to go to the convention because most destination organizations only send a handful. So anything we can do to kind of broaden that audience to that group, I think is a win. We just need to figure out how to, maybe once we get a few more hybrids under our belt, it'll be easier and won't take so much time to put together.
Again, that's actually a great sort of transition before we start an interview process. But just for the audience to understand, our full suite is going to be hybrid for the year of 2021. So as mentioned, in a couple of weeks, we have CEO Summit occurring, but then, you know, Baltimore. But in addition to Baltimore for annual conference, it's also going to be the Marketing and Communications Summit. So make sure you get them all right. Finance, Operations, and Technology Summit, Membership Summit, and then Visitor Services also occurring in some capacity, be it virtual or hybrid, as part of annual. And then after it, of course, in addition to, don't we can't forget, also Education, our CDME is occurring in Baltimore. And again, in the fall, we're actually going to have another hybrid with Conventions, Sales, and Services in September. And then our favorite, the name we share and is the most important one, anyone can tell me otherwise, is going to be Advocacy Summit at the end of October, also hybrid in Houston, and also will be CDME as part of it. So like for us, this is it. Like this is 2020. Like if 2020, what the word of the year was, you know, you're on mute. I think 2021 will be, it's hybrid or it's going hybrid. But in particular, to see the end of the year, to end it, you know, with all of these, I'm looking forward to it. So
just mark those dates for Advocacy Now, October 26th through the 28th.
Yeah. As we said earlier, each month we will interview a guest on their tale of advocacy and a role it played in a pivotal moment in their destination. For this episode, we want to introduce you to the newest member of our team, Gabe Cedar, Senior Director of Advocacy, Policy, and Program Development. Gabe has been with us just shy of a year and a half and has literally been put through the gauntlet of trial by fire for our sector and the pandemic. However, Gabe's work with our industry goes back much further than that and is worth talking about in his broader themes towards destination development, and in particular, in underdeveloped parts of the world. Gabe, let's begin. All right, so Gabe, even though you are the newest team member by a year and a half, it's through a pandemic year, which probably is considered dog years. I think it's kind of worth pointing out a little bit. Let's back up. Just run through what makes Gabe Gabe. What is your background to get to, from where we were before 2020 to this point? You know, where you're from, your education, interest that kind of led you to here.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, Andreas. So I kind of took a bit of a circuitous route to Destinations International. And unlike, you know, a lot of our staff, I don't really have a lot of experience working with the CBB, but I do have a good deal of experience working in tourism, and specifically in tourism development. I started in international development. I studied international development in school. I went to GW, George Washington University here in DC, and was interested in working sort of in the development sector and working internationally. And found my way into tourism as a vehicle for international development. So for about 10 years before joining Destinations International, I worked on development projects that were funded by international donors, like USAID is the development arm of the US government, and other funders like that, that would look at how they could support specific sectors as part of economic development, you know, programs. And I specialized in tourism, and I worked specifically in tourism development. So over that time, I worked in many, many destinations, maybe about 20 countries or so, where, again, we'd be hired to go in and look at how, you know, the tourism industry could be supported and how investments can be made in the tourism industry that would ultimately result in economic development, job creation, and so on. So that had a few different elements. You know, there was workforce development and training would be part of that. You know, destination branding, marketing would be part of that. Looking at attracting investments, looking at how you're able to make investments in the private sector. But one thing that really tied it all together was the need in these places, in these destinations, for some sort of unified destination organization, some sort of entity that would catalyze development in the industry. You know, certainly destination marketing was lacking, destination promotion was lacking in all of these places. And so having an entity that would be, you know, funded specifically to do destination promotion and then to tackle, you know, various other initiatives around destination stewardship, around destination management, was important as well. So I spent about 10 years looking at how we're able to establish destination organizations in these places. In the course of that work, obviously got to know Destinations International very well. I spent a lot of time tracking the work that you, Andreas, and Jack were doing. And over time, I wound up here as well.
So just to back up one bit, though, like everyone here in DC, you are not from DC. Where are you from?
That's true. Yeah, I grew up a little bit outside Portland, Maine. So I'm from the East Coast. I spent my whole life on the East Coast. Yeah, I grew up in a small town in Maine and been here in DC for, 15 years or so?
I believe you're the only one of the three here. I mean, I know you, if I remember correctly, you have a tattoo of the state, right?
I do. Yep. Yeah, I do.
Jack, do you got a tattoo of Illinois? I don't got one of Maryland. So yeah. I just point that out because that's something you literally wear on your sleeve.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, no, I love the state. And that's a good observation, Andreas.
So, I mean, I think part of your background was so interesting to myself and Jack was just your role in these, you know, literally destinations that you said right now that they needed a destination organization versus here, you know, largely in North America, there's some establishment of, you know, we certainly argue over like fighting for relevancy and that type of stuff, but they understand that there should be something there. What do you think is a common misconception that the rest of the world either has or doesn't have of destinations that we don't have here?
I mean, it's a good question, Andreas. You know, I think there's a couple things. So, you know, there's kind of a common misconception that, you know, is present in any destination of any size, which is that, you know, we don't need to market this place. People are going to come here because we live in this special place. You know, we've got great beaches. Everybody's going to want to come here. There's no need to be marketing these beaches. And, you know, that is true, I think, of the most established destinations in the U.S. or in the world, as well as, you know, the sort of least established, least visited places as well. And, you know, as we know, and as you guys do a great job of telling everybody, that's just not true. You know, there needs to be some degree of promotion of these places. And it's not really a case of if you have it, people will come. So first and foremost, you know, is this just need to, you know, establish sort of a consensus that there is a need to do marketing, do promotion. You know, typically the private sector is on board with that already. You know, they understand that there needs to be that promotion that's taking place. You know, sometimes the public sector, the government is or is not already on board with that. You know, typically it's sort of residents or non-tourism sector stakeholders that have the hardest time getting on board with that and understanding why destination promotion is important. Again, I'm speaking in generalizations here, but you know that's certainly been my experience. So I would say misconception number one is simply just the need for destination promotion. You know, after that, you can kind of take your pick.
Let me ask you this, because you used one of the acronyms, CVB, Convention and Visitors Bureau. How many outside the United States consider itself or as important as we do of like an active meeting and convention component to a destination versus like we do here, in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. You know, I think it's going to vary depending on, obviously, based on the destination that you're talking about, the size of the destination that you're talking about, if a destination has a convention center or meetings facilities, then a CVB is going to be important. If you're talking about a destination that does not have those facilities, then naturally you're not going to need to be selling conferences. Mm-hmm. But in that case, you see other markets that are important. So you see, you know, destination organizations that are out there, you know, selling events, for instance, you know, non-conference events, or just focused on, you know, leisure markets. And again, you know, I think in the U.S., they tend to be unified. You tend to see convention and visitor bureaus sort of unified into one organization. That's not universally true. You know, I think in a lot of destinations, to some extent in the U.S., but especially in Europe, what you see are, you know, organizations that will be focused specifically on selling meetings and events on one hand, or also have visitor bureaus on another, you know, tasked with different objectives and measured by, you know, a different rubric.
So prior to us, you were, you know, roaming the globe as a consultant to destination organization. Did you ever see yourself wanting to maybe work at one or be at a destination organization? Or did you kind of like the kind of hands-off, you know, consultant aspect of stuff? I will help you get you there, but I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to be involved in the day-to-day.
Yeah. Those who can't do teach, right? So, I think it would be when I kind of envisioned where I would want to go. There's a few different roads, and that would certainly be something that would be interesting. I think that what I valued in that work was that, you know, you're oftentimes working with a group of stakeholders who are really passionate about their place, really excited about their place, and kind of building something new, which, you know, I think was really exciting. You know, there's a whole set of challenges that come with that that are maybe different from the set of challenges that are experienced once you have, you know, an entity established. It was neat to be able to tackle that side of it. You know, certainly coming into Destination International and working with a lot of our members, you know, it opens your eyes to this whole other world of challenges and sets of issues that established destination organizations have to deal with. And, you know, obviously there's a whole world of opportunity to work with them on these as well. And then in terms of what comes next, you know, I don't know. I think, you know, it could be fun. It could be really exciting. Obviously love working with a lot of our members and could be really exciting to work with them, but I hadn't really thought about it, to be honest with you, Andreas.
I think one of the interesting dynamics between the three of us is this is all I've ever known. You were traveling the globe, and then Jack, even to bring you into it, you got involved with the desertization and, you know, the venue stuff. I mean, later in your career, you were an accomplished entity in the political sphere. You know, that is what your background is and what has made you so effective in this. I kind of want to bring how Gabe saw the world at that point. I'm just curious what led you becoming to choose. How did you see the world and travel and tourism and destinations? If it at all was as part of your, you know, viewpoint at all?
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't first in mind when I started my career, maybe being at a Gabe's age. Literally politics was everything I wanted to do. And I'm still fascinated by it. I had this fantasy of becoming governor of Colorado because I thought Colorado was an amazing state. I love the Rocky Mountains. And then I would become vice president, which I thought was a great gig because it didn't have a lot of responsibility, but you got to travel all over the world. And then maybe flip into president. Falling into tourism was the whole McCormick Place and Navy Pier experience. As most people who've been in a convention and convention bureau situation, it's often an uneasy marriage. There were times when we were actually on the same page. There were times when we just wanted to fire them, the Chicago Convention and Tourism Bureau, and create our own. Fixing that was one of my goals, but it literally, I fell in love with the industry from the meeting side of the equation. And just being able to walk through McCormick Place and just see what was happening during a trade show. I mean, you can actually feel it. It is really cool. So not necessarily out to save the world, but out to save capitalism, I guess. I don't know. That's where I was going with it.
Let me tie it back. I mean, there's another part of your title, Gabe, that you also, this is what you do here with us, and that's the, you know, the program development. That's DMAP, you know, the accreditation program. Something unique is each of us has a unique part of DMAP of like a history with it. So myself, I was the person, one of the people at my former organization who helped facilitate getting the documents and that type of stuff. And I remember my old boss at the time just saying, this is a massive deal because some cities do parades for their accredited destination organizations. And I never found out who that destination got the parade was, but all we got was a plaque that lived behind the receptionist desk.
Jack, are you with me, Baton Rouge?
What's up? I don't know who it was,
Baton Rouge? Oh, God, no.
Someone claimed that they got a parade.
Oh, it was Brian. Me and Brian went to Baton Rouge, just so you understand. I actually presented the DMAP certificate to them three times.
So it's not fabled. There is. So I always had that kind of taste for my mouth was just like, I know this is a big deal. I'm putting through a lot of paperwork to do this. And all I got was the plaque. Gabe, yourself coming into it now, handling the program, why should everyone do it? I mean, just to hear from you yourself, why should everyone become accredited?
Yeah, well, Andreas, we were talking about this before we started recording. And, you know, I mentioned that it's funny sometimes how things work out where, you know, I'm managing this program. where, you know, I spent a long time going through those DMAP standards, you know, our accreditation standards, and used those for years as sort of a roadmap of what a successful destination organization looks like, you know, how it's structured, how it makes its priorities, and so on. And, you know, sometimes when we're starting out, you know, establishing a destination organization, you know, it seems kind of far-fetched to think that we'd be able to have all of these different things in place. But, you know, it provided a roadmap for us and, you know, something to structure our work around. And, you know, I think that's true of any destination organization. You know, whether it's, you know, a one-man shop or one-woman shop, you know, in rural Malawi, or it's, you know, Baton Rouge, like you're talking about, Jack. You know, for those that don't know, DMAP is our accreditation program for destination organizations. To participate in the program, you demonstrate that you're compliant with 110 or so standards across about a dozen different domains. Everything from, you know, how you're structured, board governance, through your human resources, your technology, sales and marketing, and so on. And it provides, you know, a pretty clear framework for what are those best practices in the industry. It allows you to go through one by one and, you know, check off, do we have a strategic plan that has the following criteria, you know, blah, 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 blah. And you say, yep, you know, we've got that. So the plan that we have in place, you know, is structured around those best practices in the industry, or else, no, we don't. And, you know, okay, so task number one is we have to develop this plan in order to meet this standard.
I mean, I think one part about DMAP in particular, I try to harp on especially, is that, like, you know, when we talk about, well, we've talked about the community shared value, right, is that we see destination promotion as a common good, you know, in comparison with other common goods. And, like, well, for example, those other common goods like education, medical facilities and whatnot, those have accreditation standards. You will very frequently see them on doors and stuff like that of colleges, or go to your doctors or your dentist. I guarantee you will see a sticker on there that says accredited and whatnot. And I think people get daunted by the work of doing it, but I think people don't realize sometimes, well, like, accreditation does mean validation. Like, it's this, one of the few things we have is this official stamp that's kind of like, you know, yes, you are a person who is the best fiduciary of measures of money, processes, and stuff like that. I just think it's something that destinations who want to be seen as a community shared value, I think it's a very easy thing to kind of lean into. That's kind of like a step one, you know, like, we are showing the world that we are, you know, one of our core values is transparency and whatnot, and this is something we can accomplish.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And, you know, I'd say as well, I'm well aware of the fact that it can be a painful and tedious process to go through the accreditation process, you know, because it is a lot of attention to detail, and it is there's a lot of requirements in there. And, you know, I can tell you that, you know, these accreditations are reviewed by a panel of, you know, independent reviewers who all come from accredited organizations, and they take their job very, very seriously. And, you know, there's each standard, you know, each of the 100 plus standards are described, you know, exactly what they're looking for. And there's very clear guidelines, and they go through meticulously. And, you know, sometimes they agonize over their decisions, and they say, look, you know, does this meet the bar? You know, they've met the letter of the standard, but do they meet the spirit of the standard, or vice versa? And, you know, it can be a tedious process. But on the other hand, I think it's, you know, like you said, Andreas, it's an invaluable thing for an organization to go through it, to understand, you know, these are the best practices. You know, these are those standards that have been established by this body of industry experts and updated regularly and debated sometimes endlessly. To, you know, to be able to say that you've met all these, you know, allows you to say that you meet all of these best practices. And it provides, you know, I think it affords you a certain degree of protection. And we talk about this all the time as an industry, as an advocacy resource. And it allows, you know, there's countless examples of our members leaning back from that accreditation when, you know, they're under the microscope for something and say, look, you know, what we're doing is the best practice in the industry. And it's something that's accepted and widely practiced and has been established as something that is, you know, again, a good practice in the industry for the following reasons.
Yeah, no, 100%. And that's why we do it.
Yeah, I keep going back to Baton Rouge, but Baton Rouge was actually going to lead a campaign for a hotel tax increase, which would help fund tourism as well as tourism infrastructure. Their first step in that campaign was to become accredited so that they could make the argument that they were a sound fiduciary. And literally, when I flew down there to present it, I presented it in front of their board. I presented it in front of the city council. I presented it in front of all their stakeholders. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, I think a lot of times you'll see, you know, new chief executives that will come into an organization, and one of their first assignments will be to bring their organization into compliance with the accreditation standards, or to renew their accreditation or something. And it's sort of, I think, there's a few reasons for this. I think oftentimes, you know, a board will make this a requirement for a new executive, and it allows that executive to, you know, understand, okay, you know, here's where we are and here's where we need to be. It helps them think through what, you know, maybe that first year or 18 months looks like, helps them identify some priorities, some gaps in the organization. And as I said before, affords them a certain level of protection and says, look, you know, this roadmap that we're laying out and these priorities that, you know, we're making right now are, you know, the established good practices in the industry.
So to all you potential CEOs out there, you heard it first. A good, easy step in the interview process is just bring up DMAP. Just say you'll bring the organization through DMAP. We'll probably get you to the door, hopefully.
So Gabe, you've done startup work in Nicaragua and Colombia and Jamaica and Liberia. I forget what other countries I could tick off. Are you like a celebrity if you go back now because you're in charge of the DMAP program?
I don't think I'm a celebrity anywhere, Jack. Maybe after this podcast.
Just curious, in those countries when you're playing startup, whatever, whether it's a tourism infrastructure, whether it's creating a destination organization, stuff like that. Obviously, here in North America, we would focus a lot on structure. We'd focus a lot on, you know, strategic planning and stuff like that. The part that's probably hardest for them to get around now is that community alignment, the paying attention to things like sustainability, and being that shared value in the community, that destination promotion is a common good. When you're working in Colombia, Nicaragua, or any of the other developing areas, is it the reverse? They've got that part down. It's just the mechanics now and the strategic planning efforts and stuff like that that they have to fill in? Because you've done a lot of work with the sustainability stuff.
Yeah. I don't think there's a universal answer for that. You know, I think, Jack, you've focused your work for the past several years on this idea of community shared value, on a destination organization demonstrating that it provides sort of downstream benefits that go far beyond the tourism sector. My expectation is that most sort of emerging destinations are nowhere near that point. You know, if you kind of think about if there's a sort of a common process that these organizations would go through, you know, I would think that sort of the unifying principle would be for just to demonstrate that a destination organization is important for the sector, you know, first and foremost, for the tourism and hospitality sector. I think that the first challenge that a lot of these new organizations have is just aligning these stakeholders in such a way that they support the destination organization, that they buy into the mission, that they become advocates for their funding. And oftentimes that means, you know, the private sector, you know, putting some skin in the game and making some investments in the destination organization. Oftentimes these, you know, early kind of stage destination organizations are funded through partnership programs, through membership programs, and that's going to require a pretty serious investment from the private sector. So they spend most of their time looking at how they get the hospitality sector, how they get you know, maybe tour operators, maybe restaurants aligned. But the idea of going outside of that sector and looking at getting, you know, investment from outside the sector is, I think, more of a challenge, at least until they've got some sort of a track record that they can demonstrate. That's not universally true, but, you know, it's, I think, the number one challenge that they have. I'm not sure if that answers your question, Jack.
Yeah.
You know, one thing that we would always talk about as well was, you know, going back to this idea of the unusual suspects, was the need to think about how the tourism sector intersects with these other stakeholder groups. So, you know, certainly those entities you would expect. Again, the hotels, the lodges, the tour operators, you know, venues, and then looking at, you know, okay, well, who else would benefit from tourism and deserve to have a seat at the table and is involved in sort of planning? And we would look at, well, what are those, you know, cultural institutions, academia, you know, the sort of those cultural institutions that oftentimes are sort of the protectors of the, some of the like the intangible assets that visitors are coming to experience in a destination. You know, we'd look at how do you get the public sector involved? How do you get the government to buy into this kind of program? How do you create an enabling environment for a destination organization? So oftentimes that means laying the groundwork for some sort of an accommodation tax or similar levy on some sector of the tourism industry that would fund this organization, you know, creating some sort of a regulatory environment that allows a destination organization to be developed. You know, these would be kind of the early stage challenges. And I think what would follow at some point, Jack, would be, you know, the message that you're always leading with, which is, look, you know, now that the destination organization is established, is providing all these benefits for the destination, how do you articulate these benefits beyond the sector? So how do you say, okay, look, you know, we're not just bringing in tourism revenues here, we're generating tax revenues that are supporting all these other public services. You know, we're developing this really positive brand for this destination, which is, you know, creating a halo effect. It's allowing private sector investment in other industries. It's attracting workers and so on. All these other things that we talk about.
Probably good end cap for the conversation, because what you're just talking about ties back to our biggest thing we put forth last year, which was our concept of, well, you know, for at annual and 2020 was, if they value, you know, they will fund you. Which was really kind of like what you're describing, you know, gave us sort of our love letter to the Unusual Suspects was like, look, you know, you may not realize this, but we you know, present and give, you know, intrinsic or direct or indirect value to your particular private industry, you know, and you should be at the table, not only just to help fund, but just so that you're at the table and have a stake in it and the success of destination promotion. So. With that, Gabe, I just want to say thanks. We're so grateful to have you with us and part of your team and all your expertise. It's been a blast. Like I said, it's been super helpful for like a lot of the stuff that I think the stuff that Jack and I had not been doing, you bring to the table that we're super thankful for. So I just want to say thank you.
Yeah, it's certainly been, you know, a fantastic learning opportunity for me as well. Certainly appreciate every opportunity, Andreas, to learn from you and all of your great experience in Baltimore and with the association, and Jack, obviously, a bottomless fountain of knowledge as well. So it's been fantastic. And, you know, the past year has been pretty weird, right? And I think maybe we're at some sort of a transition point here, and maybe things are going to start to change, and the next year is going to look maybe even a little bit stranger. So we'll see.
That strategic inflection point.
Yeah.
Yeah. One can hope. So, Gabe, thank you.
All right. Thanks, guys. Thanks, Andreas.
Thank you again for joining Destinations International for this month's episode of the Architects of Destination Advocacy. Please make sure to subscribe within your podcast listening service to always catch the latest episode. To learn more about the work we do, please make sure to subscribe to our newsletter at destinationsinternational.org or check out our content through the advocacy section at our site or where we're speaking at one of our upcoming events. Thank you, and we'll talk soon.